your attention to some of next term's speakers. The program has not yet been printed. It will be shortly. And it promises to be a very stimulating series of sessions that we will be having. Amongst our speakers, we have Connor Cruz O'Brien, Jeffrey Simpson, Ann Medina, and Jill Conway. That's not all, but it's possibly a representative sample, certainly a good sample. So next term, it seems to me, will equal this term in the outstanding quality of our speakers, and therefore I very much invite you to attend with the same regularity that many of you have been this term. Normally, at this time in the evening, I try to induce you to take out membership in the Institute with a mixture of wit, humor, and cajolery. Tonight, however, I must say that levity seemed somewhat out of place for two reasons, which struck me very much as I was thinking about my comments. First of all, the drama of Lucienne Bouchard's successful struggle for life has moved all of us and given us, I guess, a deep sense of the seriousness of existence. And secondly, there is the wartime focus of tonight's lecture. In these circumstances, humor seemed inappropriate to me in the midst of these reminders of pain, suffering, courage, and war, so I have not pursued my normal routine. Tonight's speaker, Dr. Jack Granitstein of York University, was born in 1939. He received his Bachelor of Arts degree from Royal Military College, his Master's degree from the University of Toronto, and his doctoral degree from Duke University in 1966. Since getting his doctoral degree, he has been with the History Department at York University in Toronto, or outside Toronto, where he is now the Distinguished Research Professor of History. His honors are many, including two honorary doctorates and numerous prizes and medals. His list of publications I can only describe as extraordinary. As I read them, I realized for the first time what envy really meant. Most scholars in their entire career produce fewer articles than Professor Granitstein produces books. Some examples. These are titles: Canada's War, The Politics of the Mackenzie King Government, 1939 to 1945. Another, The Ottawa Men, The Civil Service Mandarins, 1935 to 1957. A third, Pirouette, Pierre Trudeau and Canadian Foreign Policy. And quite recently, in 1993, The Generals, The Canadian Army's Senior Commanders in the Second World War. This book, The Generals, won the J.W. Defoe Prize for 1993 for the best book on Canada and international affairs, and also the University of British Columbia Medal for Canadian Biography. If any of you believe that academics are lazy, cosseted individuals who teach a few hours a week and lounge on beaches in the summertime, Jack Granitstein is living proof to the contrary. He is, in a sense, a one-man army of historians. Hence, the appropriateness of his title for tonight's talk, quote, "The Generals, the Canadian Army's Senior Commanders in World War II," Dr. Jack Granitstein.
Thank you very much. My object was always to teach no hours a week of classes. I know that a few Saturdays ago, Judge Rosalie Abella was one of your speakers, and Rosie Abella is an old friend of mine, and when I saw her after she came back, she said she'd just been in Vancouver, she knew I was going to follow her, and she said, "It's the most extraordinary thing. They get all these people out on Saturday night. I don't know how it happens, and I don't either. But I must say, I think it's wondrous, and you are all to be congratulated." I, I would hate to think that I'm, or my subject is responsible for the financial crisis of this institute, but my subject is in fact the war and the generals who commanded Canadian troops in that war, and I want to begin by reminding you of 50 years ago. 50 years ago this weekend, the Royal Canadian Navy was escorting convoys in the North Atlantic and on the Murmansk Run and manning destroyers that were shelling German targets in Norway. 50 years ago, this night, Number 6 Group of Bomber Command was engaged in a series of almost nightly attacks, a series of attacks on German synthetic oil production and continuing its assault on German industrial cities, much to the chagrin of the producers of The Valor and the Horror. 50 years ago this night, Number 1 First Canadian Corps was on the attack in the area of the Lamoni River in northern Italy and suffering very serious casualties in the process. 50 years ago tonight in the Netherlands, the 1st Canadian Army was in the Nijmegen bridgehead trying to cope with the problems caused by the Germans having opened the dams and flooded the area almost completely. 50 years ago this night, in prisoner of war cages in Hong Kong and Japan, the Canadian survivors of the Battle of Hong Kong in December 1941 were finishing their third year in captivity and enduring unspeakable conditions. And the Canadian prisoners of war from Dieppe and from other air, sea, and ground battles in Europe were similarly enduring difficult conditions. And 50 years ago this night in Ottawa, the conscription crisis having been resolved 10 days earlier when the King government decided to send home defense conscripts overseas, the government at last was beginning to breathe a little easier. I say this only to remind you of what most of you already know, that in the Second World War, this country made an absolutely massive effort on air, sea, and land that spanned the globe. 1.1 million Canadian men and women wore uniform, 10% of the population. Millions more worked in war factories, in the fields. Housewives saved fats, collected tinfoil. Kids collected tinfoil. I can remember collecting tinfoil and milkweed pods. God knows what they did with the milkweed pods. In the most organized effort this nation has ever seen. It was truly Canada's war in every respect. My subject is the military side of this effort, and most especially the high command of the Army. In World War II, Canada produced an army of 5 divisions, 3 of which were infantry, 2 of which were armored, and 2 additional armored brigades, and put 750,000 men in uniform. Now that's an absolutely astonishing number when you consider that this week, a white paper, defense white paper, proposes that this country can barely support Army, Navy, and Air Force totaling 60,000 men and women, and that brags in its paper about increasing Army strength by 3,000. The CBC had more people than that covering the D-Day commemoration last June. More than 10% of our army of 750,000 in the Second World War became casualties, killed, wounded in action, missing in action. A very high percentage when you realize that of those 750,000, perhaps 500,000 were safely out of the line. That army was commanded by 68 officers of major general rank or higher. Some of them became very famous for their efforts. Men like Andy McNaughton, Harry Crerar, Guy Simmons, Charles Foulkes, names that were once household words, but names that are now remembered only by the very old or by the very few historians that believe that Canada's military past is worth study. These men had their strengths and their weaknesses, needless to say. But that Canada was able to produce men of that caliber, men who were able to command large formations in the field, was in fact a miracle. And I use that word quite deliberately. It was a miracle because of the way we had neglected our armed forces in the years between World War I and World War II. In 1939, the professional army, the permanent force as it was called, numbered 4,500. It had 450 professional officers. At least half of them, at least half of that 450, as General Christopher Vokes said, were useless for active service, either from old age, ill health, or inefficiency. And that, he said, was a state of affairs brought about by a feeling of security in the service which permeated the peacetime army, provided an officer, no matter how lazy or incompetent, could avoid sudden death or grave misbehavior, he could look forward to a ripe old age in the service. It was the equivalent of tenure in the universities, I think. Many others had passed too much time in the mess in the long interwar years to be ready to fight. Drink was the curse of the permanent force, another officer said. The militia was an even worse condition than the regular force. It had a paper strength of 50,000 men, with perhaps 5,000 or 6,000 officers. However diligent they were, and many of the militia officers were very diligent, one night a week of training and the possibility of 2 weeks of training during the summer each year was enough to learn only the basics of parade square drill and the most rudimentary tactical training. The simple truth was, as the Dean of Canadian Military Historians, Charles Stacey, wrote, Canada had no troops ready for immediate action. The tiny permanent force did not constitute a striking force capable either of counterattack or expeditionary action. The militia, with its limited strength, obsolescent equipment, and rudimentary training, was incapable of immediate effective action of any sort. And yet, by 1943, Canadian soldiers were participating in combat with increasing success. And by 1945, the 1st Canadian Army, with its 5 divisions and 2 armored brigades, was every bit as effective as any army on either side in this war. Well, how? How did this miracle occur? The 1st Canadian commander, Andy McNaughton, recognized that only time could create competent commanders. It took time for people to learn their jobs. And I think that Canada was extremely fortunate that almost 4 years elapsed before our army faced any sustained action. Otherwise, the disasters at Hong Kong and the disaster of Dieppe might well have been the norm and not the exceptions. General McNaughton told Fortune magazine, the American business publication, in 1943, in a wonderful metaphor, that the older officers were a cover crop that allowed the young saplings to develop out of the direct heat of the sun. That's a very Canadian metaphor, and it was exactly right, even if Andy McNaughton did not realize that he too was part of the cover crop that had to be cut down before the young officers could take over. Now, I want to talk about two officers in particular tonight, two Vancouver generals who served in the Second World War. One, Victor Odlum, was part of the cover crop. The other, Bert Hofmeister, was one of those young saplings. The two, to my mind, say much about the problems and triumphs of the Canadian Army and its leadership in the Second World War. I'll begin with General Odlum, who, like everyone else in Vancouver, was born in Ontario in 1880. He was raised in Japan and in this city, and he left this city to go off to the Boer War in 1899. When he came back, having done very well, he worked in the newspaper business here, eventually finally achieving freedom of the press by owning a newspaper. Then he sold bonds and insurance, and I gather there's still an Odlum name in the business world in this city. In 1914, he enlisted, went overseas, and by 1916, during the First World War, he was a brigade commander in the 4th Canadian Division. He was wounded three times in action. He won two Distinguished Service Orders. He was widely considered to be a veritable lion in action, a brave and skillful commander. Had the war not ended in November 1918, it was quite likely that he would have got a division to command. But it did end. Served in the militia for some years after the end of the war, and in 1925, he went on to the Supplementary Reserve, which is to say he ceased his effective connection with the military. His interests turned to politics. He worked for the Honorable Ian Mackenzie, who was British Columbia's cabinet minister in the Mackenzie King governments. He sat in the legislature as a Liberal. He served on the board of governors of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And in 1939, when the Second World War began, Odlum launched a political campaign to get a division, to command a division. And he called on all his friends. Ian Mackenzie, who had been Minister of National Defense until a few scandals forced him out in just after the beginning of the war, was Minister of Pensions, and he worked very hard for his friend Odlum. Mackenzie King recognized loyalty when loyalty was accorded to him. Military friends wrote letters to the defense minister saying that Victor Odlum was Canada's best general. He may have been. We were in pretty rough shape in 1939. In April 1940, the campaign paid off. Odlum was given command of the 2nd Canadian Division. Mackenzie King wrote that this was a good thing because, after all, Odlum was from the militia and the militia was entitled to its rewards. And besides, he was from British Columbia and British Columbia was entitled to its rewards. In fact, Victor Odlum in 1940 was 60 years old. He was 15 years away from even militia experience, and he had received his appointment through party politics. But who else was there around who was competent? Effectively, almost no one. There were a few permanent force officers who were mentioned for the 2nd Division, but they were just as old as Odlum. And when Victor Odlum left to go overseas with his division in the dreadful summer of 1940, Mackenzie King wrote in his famous diary that he looked young and really radiant, a fine spirit, a gallant fellow, a brave heart, a fine soul. All true, I'm sure. But the problem was that Victor Odlum was unfit for modern war. In his papers, which are in the National Archives in Ottawa, the records of his time in command of the 2nd Division are effectively complete. And they're full of Odlum's goodwill and his energy and his efforts to create brass bands, to work out a new system of map references to protect their secrecy in action, to design a distinctive arm patch for his division that would recollect the great efforts of the 2nd Canadian Division in World War I, but almost nothing about training, almost nothing about tactics, almost nothing about fighting a war. He was also, as the next senior officer to General Macnaughton, the commander of the Canadian Corps whenever Macnaughton wasn't there. And the simple truth was that his officers lived in fear that sometime when Macnaughton was away, Odlum might do something. The regrettable truth is that Victor Odlum was ready to fight the last war, to rally the troops in the trenches to beat the Kaiser. The British could see this. The British had a lot of officers like Odlum too. General Sir Alan Brooke, the chief of the Imperial General Staff, told Macnaughton that Odlum, while gallant and loyal, was too old, too set in his ways, too set to adapt to modern war. But what to do with this man and his powerful political connections? No one knew until Mackenzie King hit upon the idea of making Victor Odlum High Commissioner to Australia. Odlum was appalled. He told the Minister of National Defense that he wanted to end his career shooting Germans. He would prefer 6 months' life here to 25 years elsewhere. But he went in late 1941, and once Japan entered the war, and once Japanese attacks drew closer to Australia, Odlum began to smell the sniff of battle once again, and he told the Australian cabinet that of course Canada would send 2 divisions to help Australia defend itself against the Japanese. And when Ottawa heard of this, really through the newspapers more than anywhere else, they were just absolutely horrified. And Odlum had to be told that we didn't have 2 divisions and the frontier for us was in across the Atlantic. We thought in those ways in those days. Odlum, a little bit chastised, wrote to Mackenzie King, "My mind is that of a fighting soldier, and I'm making no progress in changing it. Sitting in the placid atmosphere of Canberra, I expect to die of slow motion, internal explosion, or spontaneous combustion." He sounds like one of the headlines in the supermarket tabloids, you know, minister blows up giving a sermon or something. Odlum regularly wrote Mackenzie King a kind of chatty series of letters. He would say, "I was out hiking 10 miles today before breakfast. I'm as fit as anyone half my age." And what he was saying, of course, was that he wanted a division. Give me a chance to fight. Well, gallant as he was, able field commander that he had been 25 years earlier, Odlum was a sign of just how unprepared the Canadian Army was for war in the first phases of the Second World War. Can you imagine, one distinguished officer later said, what would have happened if the 2nd Division commanded by General Odlum had been in action? Well, this part of the cover crop was gone, and others followed, weeded out by General Alan Brooke, weeded out by Bernard Montgomery in wholesale lots. For times it seemed that transports were carrying sacked generals by the shipload back to Canada. What remained in England? What remained was an army that increasingly became a meritocracy, an institution where people rose on their ability. The case in point is my other Vancouver officer, Bert Hoffmeister. When my book, The Generals, came out a year ago, I got the most extraordinary flood of mail. I've never had a response, a kind of over the transom response like that. A lot of it was very critical. I had got so-and-so wrong and I'd screwed up the interpretation of this. Harry Crerar's son threatened me with a libel suit, although I don't think you can libel the dead. I was criticized very severely by other people for being too favorable to Crerar, which leads me to think that I had him just right. I said that Simmons was our ablest field commander, and I've been attacked for that in more reviews and in more letters than I can count. But about one officer, the reaction was completely different. I had simply not sung Bert Hoffmeister's praises loudly enough. I know that from what John Cairns said, that next term, Jill Conway is coming here to speak. Her husband, John Conway, was an officer on Bert Hoffmeister's staff, and he wrote me. He taught at York University when I arrived there, and so I know him for long standing. And he wrote me to say that Hoffmeister, and I quote, was the finest man I have ever met. There was not one whisper of complaint from anyone against Hoffy, as he was known, who was the creator of what was called the Mighty Maroon Machine, which was the 5th Canadian Armored Division. Well, why and how? How was it that this officer established this extraordinary reputation? He was actually born in Vancouver in 1907, his father an employee of H.R. Macmillan. He went to public school and high school here. He didn't go to university. He went to work in the Macmillan timber empire like his father. He had joined the Seaforth Highlanders cadets in 1919 when he was 12. And he became an officer in the regiment in 1927. And although that regiment was very social then, and he wasn't, and although he had to scrounge money to buy his uniform, and a Highlander's officer's uniform was pretty expensive then and still, he found the money somehow. He was big, strong, athletic, and he loved the Seaforth's emphasis on sports and drill. But God knows they didn't do any serious military training, but there was a lot of sports and drill. And by 1939, he was a 32-year-old major, and he took a company overseas when the Seaforths joined the 1st Division in England. He was not happy in the service. The officers, in his view, were preparing to face the best army in the world, the German army. And he and his men were not trained for that task. When I talked to him a couple of years ago, he said that he remembered the farewell ceremony in Vancouver when the regiment went overseas. They paraded at their armories, then the ranks broke up and people said their goodbyes, and parents of the men in his company came up to him and said, "Look after my boy." And Hoffmeister had said he would. And he knew that he was simply unprepared for that task. He didn't know how to look after their boys because no one had ever told him how or trained him how. And he realized that no one in his regiment, in his brigade, in his division, And when there was a corps formed, no one in his corps knew what they were to do. He tried to get on some courses so he could learn what a company commander is supposed to do. His commanding officer wouldn't let him go. If we let you go on a course, someone will see that you're good and you'll be stolen away by some other formation. I'll lose you. It disturbed me to no end, he said, to realize that here I was, a company commander responsible for 120 to 130 men, and I didn't know how to look after myself in battle, let alone them. Now, what was the response for Hofmeister in this situation? The response, essentially, was that he had a nervous breakdown. In January 1941, he was in his quarters, and he stepped into a bath, put his leg over the tub and stepped into the bath. Then he put his other leg in, and he realized the water was scalding. Now, when he told me this, I've been in England, I know it's impossible to get hot water in England, and it would have been worse in 1941, but this is the way he tells the story. He realized that he'd lost all feeling in one leg and one side. He was paralyzed on one side. Within days, he was at the Army's number one neurological hospital, known as number one nuts, where a Toronto psychiatrist took him under his care and in the space of about 3 weeks rebuilt Hofmeister's personality. 3 weeks of intensive therapy. If he thought he had problems, he was wrong, Hofmeister was told. Your seniors, your colonel, your brigadiers have said you can do the job. If these people think you are capable of doing the job, then you are capable of doing it. Do your best and don't worry, he was told. Now, this sounds absurdly simplistic, but it seemed to work with Bert Hofmeister. And the simple truth is that once that crisis was over, Hofmeister never looked back. It's remarkable that he was allowed to rise, given that medical history. There was certainly one major general who was sacked because he developed what were thought to be psychological problems, and he was out of his command post literally like that. Hofmeister does not seem to have had any difficulty, although this was sitting on his record. He did some more regimental and brigade duty in England. Then he's sent back to Canada to take the staff college course at the Royal Military College, and he does brilliantly. He goes back to Britain as the commanding officer of the Seaforths. He house cleans the regiment, sacks officers that he doesn't think are up to their job, gets rid of senior NCOs. He works the regiment hard. And by God, it starts to be known as the best regiment in its brigade. He takes it to Sicily in July 1943 when the 1st Canadian Division finally goes into action. On board ship, taking the Seaforths to the invasion of Sicily, Hofmeister goes around to each platoon, to each group of 30 men in his regiment, explains the plan, spends hours talking to the men, telling them what they have to do, preparing them for what they will face. That was, when I was in the Army, that was something we were always taught we were supposed to do. It was called man management. The officer had certain things that he was directed to do, and you had to do them every time. The simple truth is, of course, that almost no one did do them. Hofmeister did. Hofmeister understood instinctively that in a democratic army, that may be an oxymoron, and I realize it. In a democratic army, officers had to know their men. They had to have their confidence and keep it. And they had to be prepared to lead by example. Hofmeister had charisma aplenty. When I talked to him, he was in a wheelchair. He'd had, I guess, what was a stroke. But he radiated charisma even well in his 80s in a way that I have seen in no other man I have ever talked to. I have interviewed Pierre Trudeau to Bert Hofmeister is that to that. He just radiated presence, like in the most astonishing way. The simple truth is that Hofmeister had nothing to worry about his men. Men wanted to follow him. He was the kind of officer that men were willing to die for. In Sicily, he demonstrated enormous ability and great courage. He led his battalion in a succession of attacks against Nazi troops in good defensive positions, and he participated in the model combined infantry and armored attack that the Canadians staged in Sicily. On November the 1st, 1943, after about 4 months of active service or service in action, he's now on the Italian mainland, and he's made a brigade commander in the 1st Division. And he is charged with the major responsibility in the Battle of Ortona, which was arguably the fiercest battle the Canadian Army participated in the entire war. The next year, in March 1944, he is made the general officer commanding the 5th Canadian Armored Division. Harry Crerar called Hofmeister to meet him at a bridge. Crerar was the corps commander. And he said to Hofmeister, "Would you like the 5th Division?" Hofmeister's reply, "Yes, sir." "Well," Crerar said, "you're a cool one." And of course he was. He was a cool one. Of course he wanted a division. He demonstrated he could command a battalion. He demonstrated he could command a brigade. And now, by God, he demonstrated he could command a division. His division, the 5th Canadian Armored Division, was still largely untried in March 1944. It had fought one battle, or its infantry brigade had fought one battle on the Arielle River some weeks earlier, and it had been creamed. It had just been slaughtered. It was a disaster. Hofmeister knew this when he took over. His first job was to get the loyalty of his officers. Commanding his armored brigade was an officer who had a pretty well-earned reputation for conspiring against his seniors. Hofmeister goes to this brigadier and says, "I don't know anything about tanks. You've got to help me." Instantly, he had the support of this officer, who remained totally loyal to him for the rest of the war. To get his infantry working, Hofmeister took each company in his division one by one and practiced them with himself in the front, moving behind artillery barrages. You move as close as you can to the leading edge of the barrage because it makes the enemy keep their heads down. And he practiced his men doing this. And as he said, inevitably a shell burst very close to him, and he could see the company he was leading in this rehearsal look at him to say, "You know, okay, smart ass, what are you going to do now?" And what he did now was to, of course, keep going. And he did that kind of effort worked remarkably in getting that division persuaded that it was a good division. He showed himself to his men. Most Canadian officers of high rank did not. He talked to the men. He won their confidence, just as he had done when he was a company commander, just as he had done when he was a battalion commander, just as he had done when he was a brigade commander. One regiment in particular in the 5th Canadian Armored Division was pretty bolshy in its attitudes. The Perth Regiment had been hit very hard in its Ariely campaign, and it seemed on the verge of mutiny, or so Hofmeister recalled. So what did he do? The brigade commander, the battalion commander, nobody could suggest how to deal with the Perth Regiment. So Hofmeister arranged for two men from each platoon in that battalion to meet with him, with no other officers or non-commissioned officers present. I explained to the men exactly what the problem was, he said, and the danger of going into battle with this lack of confidence and the poor morale that existed. And I said that we were going to stay here until I had the answers. I said, I don't have your names, speaking to the men, and I don't want to know your names. Nothing you say here is being recorded. This is for my information only, so that I in turn may take the necessary action to get this unit in shape to fight. So we sat there and looked at each other, Hofmeister said. Not a word was said, and this went on a long time. Finally, a bit of dialogue started to develop, and we worked this around by question and answer to the point where four officers were named as having performed very badly in the Ariely attack. The men had absolutely no confidence in them and were reluctant to go into battle with them. That was the reason for the low morale. I dismissed the men, went back to my headquarters, called in the brigade commander and the battalion commander, and ordered him to dispose of these officers forthwith. Now, this was not the usual way a general dealt with this kind of situation. Some Canadian senior commanders in the Second World War would have been more likely to ring artillery around the Perth Regiment's camp, threaten to shell them unless they shaped up. Hofmeister handled it in a sensible, consensual way. And it worked, and the Perth Regiment became an excellent fighting battalion. Well, why was Hofmeister so effective? A lot of it, without question, was instinctive with him. But I think it's important to remember that when he gets a division in March 1944, only 6 months previously, he had been leading a battalion in action. And he could still remember what was involved. He knew what men could and could not do under fire. There were some tasks that were beyond human ability. He knew this. He knew that you could only push people so far. He understood that his task was to motivate men, to make them willing to fight, and if necessary, to die to achieve an end. And he knew this could not be achieved simply by ordering, make it so. He had to make his men, in the dreadful current jargon, stakeholders in the operations of the division. And he did. And in my view, he was the only Canadian general in the Second World War who had that ability. He was the only Canadian general to make his division have a sense of itself as a formation, a division with a genuine esprit de corps. Hoffie's mighty maroon machine was real to the men in it. Now, this is an extraordinary state of affairs, if you think of it. Here we are, fighting with our allies, fighting a wholly just war against a monstrous enemy. And our senior officers tend to act more like Prussians than the Germans. We have a senior officer's abrupt, cold, gray men who often seem to worry more about controlling their own troops than about the enemy. In a country that likes to think of itself as perhaps not as free-spirited as the United States, but certainly much more initiative, or given to initiative than the British, there was no stress on initiative in the Canadian Army, no rewarding enterprise, almost none of that flexibility in action that we should have instinctively, if only because hockey is our game, if ever we play it again. The Germans, however, were different. Again, this is simply extraordinary. Here, Nazi officers, ruthless in enforcing discipline with executions, the SS and the Gestapo ensuring ideological purity, representing a regime of unparalleled evil. The German army, nonetheless, finds a way to involve its troops, its men, willingly in fighting the war. May 1st, 1945, the Cape Breton Highlanders in Hoffmeister's division puts in an attack on the Dutch town of Delfzijl. May 1st, a week before the end of the war, a week before VE Day, and really about 3 or 4 days before the effective end of the war. It's the, in the regimental history of the Cape Bretoners, which has just appeared, there's an account of this battle. 20 Cape Breton Highlanders are killed on May 1st, 1945. Imagine getting killed a week before the end of the war. In the history, it's described by the men who participated in it as the toughest fight this battalion had had in the war. This is a battalion that had fought its way through Italy and through some heavy actions in Holland. Now, how is it that an army, the German army, surrounded, defeated, its leadership starting to kill itself or to flee, Hitler on May 1st, in fact, having committed suicide, how is it that this army can put up on May 1st the toughest fight the Cape Breton Highlanders see during the war? What is it that inspired these people, even serving the evil regime they were serving? There's only one Canadian historian who's tried to grapple with these questions, Bill McAndrew of the Directorate of History of National Defense Headquarters. And he noted correctly that it is ironic that an authoritarian society produced a more flexible, decentralized approach to battle than its democratic enemy. The simple truth is that the Canadian Army practiced bureaucratic centralization and rigid hierarchical control, not unlike Canadian business of that era, but not Bert Hoffmeister. He didn't do this. He continued to lead from the front. He continued to inspire his officers and his men to extraordinary feats. When his division attacked the Hitler line in its first major divisional size action in May 1944, there were a lot of mix-ups, in part because Hoffmeister was at the front and couldn't be reached by his staff officers who needed decisions. The division did pretty well for its first major action. The highlight of his career in Italy was the breaking of the Gothic line in late August 1944, an action that some have called, me I guess, the single best operation of the Canadian Army in the Second World War. And significantly, an operation that seized a chance opportunity and took advantage of a sudden German weakness, flexibility and initiative, in other words. Hofmeister led his division, as I've suggested, to Holland in February and March 1945, when 1st Canadian Army was reunited, and he fought it with equal skill there. At one point in April 1945, at a little town called Otterloo, fleeing Germans overran his division's headquarters, and Hofmeister, in pajamas, led the defense. His talent was recognized, his skill as a senior commander was recognized, when this militiaman, who had become Canada's best fighting soldier, was selected over a host of permanent force applicants to command the division Canada was sending to participate in the invasion of Japan, an invasion that happily did not become necessary. Simply put, Hofmeister was a leader of the modern type. Unlike Odlum, he was young. He was flexible enough to adapt to the requirements of a Second World War battlefield. Unlike Odlum, he understood that he had to lead by example. He had to be seen to be leading. Unlike Odlum, he had the ability to inspire men to great deeds, even at the risk of their lives. Unlike the rigid, hierarchical, permanent force professional soldiers, this militiaman was instinctively consensual in approach. What he was a powerful, charismatic leader, the single best soldier this country produced in the Second World War. Now, there are only two of our World War II generals still alive, Hofmeister and George Kitching, who lives in Victoria. Hofmeister is, I think, almost totally unknown outside of British Columbia. And perhaps, given the results of my informal polling since I got here yesterday, perhaps not all that well known here now. This is very sad. There's an Odlum Street in East Vancouver, but I don't think there's a Hofmeister Avenue, and there should be. What is sad, what is really sad in the present, is that leadership of Hofmeister's type seems to have been largely forgotten in today's Canadian forces. Last month, I was sent for comment a draft statement headed "The Officer," designed, as it was put, to characterize the Canadian Forces officer of the future. And this came from something called the Officer Development Review Board, which operates out of Kingston, Ontario. And it goes on for 2 pages. And let me read you a couple of sentences from this report just to give you a sense of what today's officer is supposed to be. "The personal quality of the officers of the future will be a complex mixture of the enduring values and ethos of the Canadian Forces. However, they will be responsive and adaptive to the complexity of the emerging environment. They will be innovative leaders of militaries that are continuous learning strategic organizations that function effectively and thrive in an environment of emerging complexity and change. The officers of the future will have the ability to lead and manage organizational infrastructure as well as assets in the context of the ethos of the Canadian Forces. These officers will have, this is the joke, will have good communication skills and will frequently be called upon to represent the military in ways that require extemporaneous verbal and writing skills. They must master complex cognitive skills. They must be able to envision the future and identify desired outcomes and articulate a vision and lead in that direction. Officers must be capable of operating across paradigms in a multidisciplinary context. I sometimes write snarky things, but I wrote a very snarky letter in response to this to say that this was gobbledygook and unreadable bureaucrat speak. It is a great pity that the white paper does not strike down the Officer Development Review Board as a cost-cutting exercise. What that extraordinary statement left out, of course, was that an officer must be able to lead. An officer must be able to lead Canadian men and women in action in war or in peacekeeping operations. An officer must know his men, care for them, inspire them, so that they can achieve their objectives under the most difficult of circumstances. In my view, in other words, what the Officer Development Review Board needed to do was to find some way to capture the spirit that Bert Hofmeister so admirably demonstrated, to bottle that and to issue it to every officer in the Canadian Forces. Thank you.
It's a good idea for you to repeat the question because
Okay. Sometimes
they don't hear.
Well, we're open for questions now. So raise your hand. Yeah.
Sir, what was your response to the review board?
I said, this is gobbledygook and it's silly. Get some leadership into it. Precisely.
When you went to the Royal Military Academy...
College. The question was, were things any different in, when I was at RMC than they had been previously? I did say that we were taught about man management, and we were, it's an awful phrase, but it did have certain purposes, and one was certainly supposed to, and this was beaten into your head every day, the officer made sure his men were taken care of before he ate his meal or dug his slit trench or whatever. But I don't think the Royal Military College is really a place that trains officers for action or for leading an action. It in my day, and still, it was in effect a university with a heavy component of drill and military studies. And I think it still is that. It was when you joined the services after the college that some wise sergeant taught you how to do your job.
Yes,
you mentioned Guy Simmons. You rated both him and Hofmeister very highly. Is it possible to compare and contrast him as to which is better, or am I asking if something that's
I'm willing to plunge in where fools and angels fear to tread. Hofmeister certainly did not like Simmons. He made no bones about it. He thought that Simmons was not his kind of officer. Simmons was abrupt. You couldn't discuss a plan. With Simmons, it was, here are your orders, carry them out. This wasn't Hofmeister's style. Hofmeister's style was, as I've suggested, consensual. The object is to bring everybody along so they're willing to do it. It wasn't Simmons' way. And so I think that's the basic key difference between them right off the bat. Simmons is someone who never commands a unit in the field, a battalion-level unit. Simmons begins in action as a division commander. So he doesn't have what I tried to suggest was the key for Hofmeister, that understanding of what men can do under fire, what a battalion is able to do. So when Simmons says, do this, it may look good on the map, but is it possible? When Hofmeister says do this, it's based on that understanding of what people are able to do. I think those two are the key differences between the two men.
The problem that you are putting forth tonight, do you suggest that this problem may have been one of the reasons for the debacle?
Which debacle?
The debacle at Dieppe.
Well, there are people here who are much better able to talk about Dieppe than I am. In 1942, there are some very good studies now of the training of the Canadian Army. Colonel Jack English has published a very good book on how the Army was trained. And he, I think, would argue, and I would agree with him, that in fact there were very serious problems that weren't corrected in the Army's command, in the Army's training, and that had a substantial impact on the Dieppe debacle. It was a green army, remember. It hadn't seen any action. It was trained as well as it could be at that time, given the theories and the practices of the day. Was it able to do the job that it was given? Well, clearly not. Well, why was that not? Well, one, the training was a mess, and I think that probably had a good deal to do with it. The other thing, of course, is that the plan was bad, and some of that must lie on Canadian shoulders, but I think most of it, and again, there's a fair amount of research and writing on this particular area, I think most of it properly belongs on Mountbatten and his staff rather than on the Canadians. But the point is that that nobody was very good at their job in the British or Canadian Army in 1942. There were very few victories to that point, I think it's worth remembering. And it's not until the end of 1942 in El Alamein that the string of victories begins for British and Canadian forces.
Let me remind the audience that I'm looking eagerly for women's arms to be raised as well as men.
Is the description of the officer that you were given to critique any way reflective of the actual situation today?
Oh, the question was, is the Officer Development Review Board statement on the officer reflective of the situation in the forces today? Every officer I've talked to in the last few years would say, oh yes, it's absolutely reflective. It's a force that increasingly is bureaucratic, managerial, filled with jargon in a way that is beyond belief. I think that statement probably reflects the reality rather than what I would think is what it should be. It's after all no different than the university, no different than any corporation. Any statement I've ever read in my university reads exactly the same. Any statement I've ever seen from any business reads the same. Everybody talks gobbledygook now. The question is, was it a requirement that you had to do active service before you went to staff college? If you mean by active service to be in action, it couldn't have been the case for the Canadian Army since until 1943, effectively, none of our people had been in action, Hong Kong and Dieppe being the only exceptions. So clearly it wasn't. We had to develop the systems before we went into action. Of course, we had a terrible shortage of trained staff officers, and we didn't have any choice. You had to train those people and then send them off to into combat.
Yes, you care to comment on the lack of political support for a general
the lack of political support that people like. Mackenzie King is almost no one's favorite these days, except mine. He still remains one of my favorites. I don't think that there was a terrible lack of political support for our generals in the field, if you mean for them personally in the tasks they're carrying out. If you mean in the supply of manpower, that's a different question. I'm not sure quite which one you're getting at. Okay, now I understand. When McNaughton was sacked, when Burns was sacked, there was no doubt that the British wanted both of those people out. The British generals made very clear to their Canadian colleagues and to Canadian politicians that both of these people were not up to the task. The Canadian government agreed and sacked them. The question now is, what were the British right? My conclusion, certainly in the case of McNaughton, was that they were. Andy McNaughton was a great man, extraordinarily intelligent, a genuine scientist with real discoveries of importance to his credit, but he was also a tinkerer and a dabbler. And he had, by 1943, when he was sacked, lost touch with his army, which didn't know him anymore. And he was widely believed by the British, and I think they were right, to not be physically up to commanding an army in the stress of battle, and probably not up professionally to doing that. So I think it was right that he had to go. Burns is a much more complex case, probably the most brilliant officer in the Canadian Army, a man of genuine intellect. I think almost literally the finest intellect in the Canadian Army. Unfortunately, he had the personality of a turnip. And he could not get on with the senior officers under him. He tried, they tried, and his personality simply didn't work with officers in the field, and it didn't work with the British either. The first time there's an attempt made to sack Burns, it's a British senior officer saying he's got to go. I think in that case, the British senior officer was trying to cover up his own errors. The second time there's an attempt to force Burns out, it's his senior officers under him. His core staff, his division commanders. Hofmeister, a loyal man, simply couldn't bear to work with Burns anymore. Chris Vokes, the other division commander, was writing letters home to Canada saying, if Burns doesn't go, I'm going to resign, and so are all the senior staff. Well, the simple truth was he had to go in those circumstances. And you can't blame the British for that one. That was Canadians saying they just could not work under this man in whom they had lost all confidence. So I don't think that you can say there's a lack of political support for our generals in dealings with the British. I think there's a willingness to give Canadians the chance, but there's also a clear recognition that we're fighting a war. If we make mistakes, people are going to get killed, and what could be worse for the politics at home than unnecessary casualties? No, I don't agree with that. First place, I don't think his job was to get ashore. He was supposed to.
I'm not saying that.
Okay. He is there's a widely shared misconception that Roberts was sacked because of Dieppe. He wasn't. He stayed in command of his division through the spring of 1943. He is sacked by Harry Crerar, who is a corps commander in England at that point, because of what Crerar believed were his failures on an exercise called Spartan, the biggest exercise that the Canadian Army staged in England. And that exercise was used to get rid of Andy MacNaughton as well, and to get rid of another corps commander, General Sansom, and also used to get rid of Ham Roberts. Now, I can't judge whether he really failed on that exercise, and it may be that he was sacked more because of Dieppe than because of Spartan, but at least he stayed on for another 8 months or so, 7 or 8 months. So it wasn't really that he was sacked directly because of Dieppe, and I don't think the question of political support comes into it. He's sacked by his military superiors for what they considered to be sound military reasons. He was an older officer. He was rated by Montgomery as the best of the Canadian division commanders in the early part of 42, which was why, in substantial part, the 2nd Division got the Dieppe job. But Montgomery made clear in his memoranda that Roberts was really the best of a pretty mediocre lot. It wasn't exactly high praise from Monty at that time. So I guess he is, in a sense, part of the cover crop. But he was a good officer. He was well-liked by his men, I believe. He had done some extraordinary things in France in June 1940 when the Canadians were sent over. It's Roberts who more or less rescues his guns. He was an artillery regimental commander then, who rescues his guns in the face of British officers saying, leave them and get out. And he insisted on taking them, which meant they were just about the only guns in England after Dunkirk. So this was not a man of no consequence, but perhaps he was too old, too slow, I'm not sure. Whatever, thought he had to go.
We have time for a few more questions.
You brought us up to date on the officer corps today. Could we step back to the First World War and look at the division that went into action in Vimy, which was only 2 years after the war had started? Was the officer corps that much better in the First World War in the Canadian Army? Better trained, should I say?
The question is, was the officer corps in the First World War better? Particularly around the time of the Battle of Vimy Ridge in April 1917. By that point, the Canadian Army had been in action more or less continuously for 2 years. Our first action is in the February-March 1915. Vimy is April 1917. We start with one division in action. It has a pretty rough time in some of its early battles, but good officers spring up. They're recognized. If they survive, they're promoted. You bring over more divisions. You transfer officers from the good divisions into those divisions. And so you build a cadre of experienced officers who have learned their trade, because God knows everyone who arrived in France in 1915 was as green as every Canadian officer in 1939. The difference is that we have 2 years in action by Vimy, so that by the time Vimy Ridge comes along, you're a supremely skilled officer corps and a very able private soldier at all levels. Again, because the ones who have survived have learned their trades very well. In the Second World War, Hong Kong is our first action, but we lose everybody. Dieppe is our next action, and the casualties are terrific. There aren't all that many survivors of Dieppe. So you don't have any experienced officers. By the time we go into Italy in July 1943, Sicily and then Italy, some officers learn on the job. A lot of them are sent back to England to work with the divisions that are preparing to invade France in 1944. But it's a small number that can be sent back. Effectively, the armies that invade in Normandy are green, with the exception of a few officers and a few senior NCOs. They have to learn on the job. There are a lot of screw-ups. There are officers sacked in wholesale in France in 1944. It takes time, clearly, to learn how you cope. That's why I said, and I picked my date quite deliberately. I said by 1945, the 1st Canadian Army was as good as any army in the field. And it was by 1945. It wasn't in June 1944. It was after it had spent most of a year learning how to do what it had to do in action. I think that's the key.
I'd love to see a womanly arm raised for the last question, if possible.
The question was asking a historian to do the impossible thing, which was to look to the future. It's hard enough to understand the past. Well, the future clearly is going to be a much less placid one than everyone had hoped when the Cold War ended. It's clear that the world is going to be as difficult and confused as it could possibly be. We are reducing our forces dramatically. When I was in the army 35 years ago, the strength of the forces was about 120,000, all three services. This white paper lays down a strength for the Canadian forces of 60,000, which means about 22,000 army. There are clear limits on what we are going to be able to do. That white paper projects the ability to send a force of 10,000 Army, Navy, Air abroad at any one time. I don't think we are able to sustain a force of that size in operations with a military of 60,000. So I think it's a bit unrealistic in that respect. It is, to judge by the editorials I've seen, and I've been trying to read what the press is saying and read the comments on this white paper, a lot of people think that 60,000 is too much. They like the idea of reducing our defense budget, which would be about 10 billion down to 7 or 8. One of the points that I hope was implicit in what I was saying tonight was that if you don't have armed services, you can pay a very heavy price. The price is not dollars, the price is your sons. You lose your sons if there's a war. Maybe there won't be a war. Everyone hopes there won't be a war. It'll be the first time in human history if there isn't a war that requires us to participate. I think it's worth the investment. I mean, we all have insurance. We all pay money for insurance on our houses and our cars and our possessions. I think defense is insurance. You hope your house doesn't burn down. But if it does, then you say, thank goodness I have insurance. We hope there's no war. If there is, I hope we have some trained officers who can do their job and win, ideally, that war without throwing away the youth of the country. So it's hard to know what's going to happen. I think we're at the absolute point where either we're going to be able to preserve the substantial military skills that the Canadian forces have today, despite what I've said about the bureaucratic cast of mind. It's a very good professional force. But if we cut it at all below 60,000, I don't think there's any chance of having any kind of promotion chain that allows people to move up into command positions. That's what, that was the situation between 1919 and 1939. And I look at Hong Kong, and I look at Dieppe, and I say those are caused by what we did, not in 1940 and 41, those are caused by what we did between 1919 and 1939. And I think that's too high a price to pay.
Thank you. I'll ask Professor Peter Sudfeld of the Psychology Department to thank our speaker.
Should I unhook?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Alan. Thanking the speaker requires one to demonstrate one's skill in extemporaneous oral communication. And since I'm a psychologist and Jack is a historian, it's even across paradigms. This being the 50th anniversary of the final years of the war, I have been thinking about it a lot, and I've been talking to my students about it a lot as well. And it seems to me that the war is really receding in memory. My students, if they know anything about it, know things on the level of the Canadian Army liberated much of Holland during World War II. But they don't really understand what they mean by the Canadian Army. They don't really understand, in fact, they don't at all understand what they mean by liberate. They have a vague idea of what Holland is. I think that the picture of armies as large formations commanded by actual human beings becomes increasingly strange as large wars recede in memory. And the commanders begin to be seen either as some kind of inhuman, impersonal force, or as some collection of colorful, memorable quirks. You know, Montgomery with the two badges on his beret instead of the regulation one, Patton with his ivory-handled revolvers, and so on. But there's no sense that there's a person there. And for some people, most of them are very much against wars, as I think everybody is against wars, but they think that to be against wars means that you have to denigrate anybody who has had anything to do with them. And for these people, military commanders are a set of martinets, fools, bloodthirsty monsters, people who are willing to sacrifice others for their own benefit and their own promotions and so on. The concept of generals as being human beings who come from somewhere, who were children and then were students and then were junior officers, and who operate in a context of the organization, the army that they're in, the resources that they have available, the kind of society that sustains that army, the kind of government that rules how that army is run, is something that people don't really think about much. And that is crucial to how commanders can inspire and lead people in situations where death is very likely. I asked one of my classes how many of them could think of a circumstance under which they think it would be worthwhile to risk their lives. 1/3 of them could think of such a circumstance. I didn't ask what the circumstance was. I'm sure it was different for each of them. But if 1/3 of them can think of a circumstance that would lead them to risk their lives, and if they're ever in a situation where they have to risk their lives, it takes commanders that are able to change that 1/3 to, let's hope, close to full complement. Otherwise, the army falls apart and the mission falls apart. And I think one of the things that Jack did in the talk tonight is to give us some understanding of where officers who can do that come from and how they're trained and how they operate within even relatively unsympathetic organizational structures and how some who can do it at one point become less able to do so as they get older and as circumstances change. So whether or not we are fortunate enough to avoid being in any major wars in the future, and I'm sure we all hope that that will be the case, that kind of understanding of how it has worked in the past and how, if it does happen in the future, it will have to work again is something that's very important and for which the Vancouver Institute and the audience can thank Jack Granitstein for enlightening us. Thank you.